from WBAT Brooklyn. It's the Batsegundo Show. And I'm coming to you today to say something I've never had to say on our program. 1 week ago, we broadcast an interview we've come to believe is much longer than previously stated. The writer, Hari Kunzru, appeared on our program. Our correspondent told us that he wouldn't talk with Mr. Kunzru for more than 40 minutes. We saw no reason to doubt him. That was a mistake. I can now say in retrospect that when our correspondent tied Hari Kunzru to his chair and refused to let him leave from the table until he talked for at least 90 minutes, we should have killed the story rather than run it. We never should have broadcast that conversation without agreeing to the 40-minute length. Instead, we trusted our correspondent's word, and he lied to us. So we decided to grill him on air. It was either that or beating our correspondent multiple times with a baseball bat. But as our listeners know, I'm not a very violent person.
I'm sorry.
Were you afraid that we would discover that your conversation was longer if we talked with Hari Kunzru?
No, not really.
Really? There was no part of you which thought, okay, the conversation really wasn't 40 minutes. Did you feel like we would discover the true running time of your conversation?
Well, I did think it would unpack the complexities of how long the conversation goes.
What does that mean, unpack the complexities?
Well, it means... it means that... you know, I mean, I think I'm agreeing with you.
I have such a weird mix of feelings about this, because I simultaneously feel terrible for you, and also, I feel lied to. And also, I stuck my neck out for you. You know, I feel like I vouched for you with our audience.
I'm sorry. Some conversations go much longer than anticipated.
So what then, Hari, do you make up when you write a novel? I mean, I also detected, for example, I saw at least two David Mitchell nods, not just Segunda, which, of course, I have also plucked, but also there is an early incident with Nicky in which he complains about the waiter not understanding that he's saying water, which I've heard David say a couple of times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was like, that's a little, you know, now I know they're friends. But I am curious about this idea of just plucking almost everything from other incidents. I mean, is this something that you can help, or do you make shit up to combat that in any way, to keep it real, or to keep it authentic, or do you not even care?
I simply think, you know, you'd be lying if you said everything is, you know, there's various positions. You know, on one sort of end of the spectrum is there are people like Kenneth Goldsmith and Tom McCarthy saying, we're at the end of this tradition, we're playing in the ruins, the only valid artistic act is a kind of reconfiguration of pre-existing material. You know, I frankly think that's much easier to say as a straight white guy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you've had 2,000 years of airtime, maybe you feel that... That's all there is. But actually, I think we're in a moment where there is a lot that is genuinely new, and there's a lot that's genuinely unsayable. So however, our experience of the world isn't of this kind of, you know, wonderful sort of romantic notion of the primary creation, you know, out of the out of nothing, and the, you know, the extraordinary poetic mind of the creator shaping raw material into art. You know, that simply is not an accurate description of the pragmatics of making literary art. Is it important to distinguish one kind of thing from another? Only when the lawyers turn up, I think. You know, I mean, I think any literate person these days is literate in a way which encompasses the notion of sources and secondariness and you know, I mean, what's, you know, bad writers borrow, good writers steal. You know, you can make something your own. David's project is interesting. David Mitchell's project is interesting. We are friends. I mean, I'm friends with Tom as well.
Yeah.
And have productive conversations with these guys about it. You know, I mean, Dave is a much more orderly character than me, I think. You know, I mean, Cloud, a lot of people are, you know, obviously because Dave's blurb my book, so that's a kind of very nice of him. But, you know, the Cloud Atlas, to which various people have sort of, you know, connected Gods Without Men, is a very different project. That's a response to Calvino's If on a Winter's Night, A Traveller, where Dave just could not stand the fact that all these stories opened and then didn't close, and he made this very beautiful nested structure where the story opens, you know, open, center, close, end. And that's one way of seeing the world, and I think, you know, it's a very formally perfect thing. I mean, and allowed him to show that he's kind of head and shoulders above most other people working today. As I said before, I'm more interested in kind of breaking that formal perfection and kind of allowing silence. I mean, a model that I have for this book was Bolaño's 2666, where there are these very big, you know, three, four big slabs of narrative that seem, as you read, to have no damn connection to each other at all, but gradually and in this kind of almost ineffable way kind of start to vibrate in harmony with each other, and it becomes clear that this is a work, you know, and I admired that so much. And I think also, given the plot at this point is so, you know, we're all, you know, plot is taught everywhere. Plot, you know, I've been in some screenwriting lately, and you know, this world of the three-act structure, and this has to happen at this point. You know, it's like wonderful little clockwork things that you can make out of plot.
Yes.
And the only way of breaking out of that slightly clockwork feeling, I think is literally by breaking out by kind of making kind of openings and making strands where things are simply not functioning as they are expected to function. And it's been quite a pleasure to see that in both the US and the UK, the reviewers who have not fundamentally liked this book have all, despite themselves, basically kind of, Mishka Kakatani basically did it in the New York Times today, I've just seen her review, they all say, you know, why was it not tied up properly? Why did he not concentrate on the straight story of this couple and their child? Why, you know, why is this sort of imperfectly integrated material been introduced in the book? And that's, you know, that's the project, and that's where I find interest.
The millions also accuse you of doing too much style, which, you know,
I mean, fair enough. You know, I mean, you know, it's a kind of, you know, I will never be a kind of cool writer in a certain sort of way, and I don't,
in a literary sort of way, or
in a kind of affectless sort of way, in that kind of, you know, in that I just
plain hard-boiled realism to gritty fiction.
I mean, I feel I have a reasonably sort of nailed down and possibly even cynical view of human relations, but in terms of writing prose, I like the idea of pretending to be an 18th century Spanish dude.
Yeah.
And I like to do the different voices. And that's the opposite of a certain sort of literary cool. You know, I mean, I think I read a lot of post-writing school American writing in particular, which I find painfully self-conscious because it's very scared of being uncool. It's very scared of what might look like style, what might look like showing off, or what might actually just look like fun.
Yeah.
And it adopts a kind of, you know, Carver is obviously the, you know, the big, you know, I mean, all the sentences are very stripped down, you know, the most kind of, you know, emotional moment is the dying fall at the end, you know, the kind of, I mean, I, you know, this stuff is now being kind of put out by the yard because it's become a kind of MFA staple. I think it's what happens when a bunch of hyper-conscious 25-year-old MFA students critique each other in a room for too long. It's that nobody, you know, this is acute self-consciousness, which I think is what you need to lose in writing. You need to basically be able to make yourself slightly ridiculous to be a writer. You need to ideally be able to make yourself a bit ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, there are writers I admire because they can be unlikable on the page.
Yes.
And because, you know, that's a interesting to me.
I agree with you, but I think we've seen a shift, especially from the agent and editors. I have heard this. Editors are saying, you know, all of the novels that I get tend to hit these same notes, this problem we're talking about, this kind of, like, you know, this fear of offending, this diffidence when it comes to chronicling unlikable characters or unlikable perspectives. On the other hand, you know, when you have agents as gatekeepers who are preventing those type of desired perspectives from actually hitting into publishers, and when you're also dealing with, of course, the need to get a return on revenue. I mean,
it's structural, isn't it? I agree. You can't just blame the writers. You have to blame the way that the industry is structured, and there are many, many ways which make books. I haven't read Chad Harbach's book yet, but it's very interesting to me that book was sort of, you know, given the keys to the kingdom very sort of immediately. I mean, my partner, the novelist Katie Kitamura, is reading it at the moment, has found it very unsatisfactory because of this notion. So there's a kind of prose that is deemed by the gatekeepers to play in the Midwest.
Yes.
You know, and hence kind of gets through. And just sort of structural stuff, like I can't have a book that looks how I want my book to look.
Yeah.
I can't do so, you know, the physicality of my book is not under my control because the publishers have certain sort of job descriptions. There's an art director, there's a designer, you know. I mean, I would have... My books would not look like the published objects that they are. Those objects, I think, should be considered as compromises. You know, you fight for the kind of cover that you feel you'd want. I mean, my visual taste is not always the visual taste of my publishers and my editors, even in terms of font, in terms of spacing, and, you know, let alone if you were to want to kind of really start fooling around with formal stuff, or if you wanted to try and open your book in some way to something that wasn't, you know, the kind of traditional novel as work. All these things exclude a certain sort of certain types of things you can do with writing and make the novel look like the novel does now. And I don't know whether it's fixable, because, you know, in a way, I'm kind of into the idea that as a writer, you're in this very impure situation. Like, my gallery artist friends are shocked by the lack of control I have over the presentation of my work, because they're able to control minutiae, because they're just trying to sell six things to six very wealthy dudes. You know, I'm trying to sell 6,000, hopefully more than 6,000, to many, many people. So there is this kind of, you're in the market, you're in this kind of very, very different kind of aesthetic world, and yet you're trying to make art in this situation, and it's an interesting one, you know.
But what do you do? Do you pull a Mark Danielewski? Do you go to Random House and sit in the Carol for 3 to 4 weeks and say, I know exactly how this novel should look? I mean, if you have to compromise on these levels, I'm curious also narrative wise, textually wise.
I mean, what
compromises do you make to keep keep it real? So
I think that's really a very personal question for each writer. People have different things that are red lines and things that aren't. I give completed drafts to agent, editor, a couple of other people, and I listen when they say, I don't understand why this is happening. And so even if I think something is clear, if I think it's not communicating to that extent, that's when I'll change. I don't know whether that counts as compromise. I dug my heels in structurally on this book, in that there was a point of view that I should cut certain sections, and that I should give more help, tied up more neatly. And that was precisely what I didn't want to do. Same with kind of previous books that, I mean, I was asked to put a glossary into The Impressionist, but I figured that would kind of be like a way of saying that this book is for non-Indian readers rather than for Indian readers who will already know these words. And I think, you know, and I'd written it in a way that I felt that all the kind of Hindi and the kind of slang words and stuff would be understandable from context. So I said no to that. Where do I compromise? I have ended up compromising on all the visual stuff. You know, I've never really beyond a certain point tried to kind of impose. I mean, publishers have house styles in terms of fonts and that kind of thing. You know, I've never really kind of tried to fight my corner very hard in that. You know,
Can you ever be happy with the final way that a book looks and feels and is?
I like some of the books that are out under my name, the objects that are under my name. I mean, I'd say I could kind of, you know, there are some, but there are editions that I'm embarrassed to carry around, like there are, I mean,
such as what?
I
let's get out the dirty laundry.
Yeah,
here.
I kind of, I don't know. It would be rude to the publishers to say which ones, but I mean, certainly, there's a couple of American paperbacks that I don't like how they look. I don't think they represent the way I would present my work at all.
Yeah. Okay, I'll let you off the hook for that one. In 2010. You went to visit Michael Moorcock in Texas. I'm a Moorcock reader as well, but this leads me to ask you, because in the Guardian essay, you do say that science fiction was your first experience of a subculture. I'm wondering, in considering how to tell the story, what you take away from genre, which does, in fact, reach people. Mm. But Moorcock has a very idiosyncratic take on it where he... Well, first of all, he has that crazy 50,000 words a day, but he also tends to have a formula that nobody else has really anticipated or tried in a novel. And so, you know, do you take anything away from genre when for this book or for other books or something like that?
I think, you know, the division between genre and literary fiction is, you know, in play at the moment. I've heard it said often by genre writers who want to give literary writers a kicking that, you know, literary fiction is now a genre.
Yeah.
I would say there's two things to say about that. Firstly, I mean, the real answer is that no, it's not. Literary fiction is any fiction which is really good.
Yeah.
I think that's all, you know, and whether it has a science fiction or setting or not. I mean, I for example would say that, you know, it's time for China Mieville to be taken very seriously as a novelist. However, there is a kind of writing that I think is actually genre writing that is pretending to be literary fiction and is marketed as literary fiction, and in fact wins literary fiction prizes rather a lot, which is this kind of my kind of personal cuss name for it is Oceans of Time. It's this sort of large-scale romance, essentially, which will be often with a historical setting, will have a realist prose, nicely crafted realist prose with quite interesting images, and will... basically trot along to some sort of transcendent or failed transcendent ending, and you know, and they give grown-up prizes to this, which is essentially, I don't think, a very reputable kind of writing, and I'm not going to name names because it will cause problems for me, but there are people that I think, you know, are getting a really weird free pass because somehow their material is marketed as being literary, whereas I think they're more schlocky than many genre writers. Now, incorporation of so-called genre elements into projects that aren't essentially genre projects, loads of people are doing that. I mean, there's a really weird kind of convergence at the moment where virtually every literary fiction writer that I care about and my friends is at least tinkering with a science fiction project.
Yeah.
That really unlikely people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to tell you off air, but I mean, science fiction, I would kind of maybe... I mean, for a while, for example, like in the past sort of high postmodern period, everybody got into the detective novel because that whole kind of structure of, you know, looking for the lost object was essentially, you know, became very interesting for these kind of philosophical reasons. That's what it, you know. At the these days, the detective genre doesn't seem to me to really be speaking to you know, our current condition in the same way. However, science fiction does.
Yes.
And I think this is why so many people are attracted to it at the moment, because science fiction is a really, really good way of doing the novels, highly kind of conceptual novels, you know, I mean, positing alternate worlds, extrapolating from current trends, making simulations, you know, I mean, it's a kind of, you know, the joy of, you know, many science fiction novels get stuck because the main fun is the simulation of the world that you've put together. It's the kind of alternate rules that you've put together in your, and in order to make it kind of consumable, people then put quite conventional characters into these worlds so that people have something to hold on to, and it falls down on the level of character because they're kind of cardboard cutouts, kind of you know. And when somebody who can kind of write character and also make a world gets involved, then it starts getting really, really good. You know, so I, you know, that's always been what I've taken from science fiction, and that's certainly why I mean, it's really very straightforward. I think you can tell from Gods Without Men, that kind of business of setting up a world with its rules, you know, and heading straight into that is very much part of what I do. You know, I mean, I used to play role playing games when I was a kid, and Moorcock was an early influence. I remember Moorcock actually was my conduit to a whole, you know, and this is why I really think that he deserves to be recognized for, is that he was an incredible cultural connector, and his fantasy novels actually incorporated quite a lot of sort of slipstream 60s, 70s psychedelic culture. I mean, you know, ranging from sort of music, you know, he was all networked into the music scene in London, through to high postmodernist experiment. You know, this is a guy who has supposedly genre novels which involve the character changing gender during the novel, where characters transfer from one novel to another and from one world to another, and the books gradually build up into this kind of
the multiverse
and this kind of this notion of cyclical time and this notion of chaos versus law. You know, he's got a kind of overarching mythos, and whereas, you know, you're sort of slightly hard pushed with Mike to pick out the book that will get the non-Mike person into his work, because it's you know, the grandeur of the project is the fact that he's sustained this whole thing across a terrifyingly large number of, you know, of short books, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 word books. And but, you know, this is the guy who's the guy who gave J.G. Ballard Acid and who put together parties where Arthur C. Clarke and Bill Burroughs are having a conversation, you know, with the dude out of Hawkwind. Now, that is, you know, that, you know, he was at the nexus of all these different currents, and, you know, and as an editor, as a publisher, and as, you know, he was a,
New,
you know, as a, from a teenager, he was publishing, you know, and editing pulp magazines, and so he has an incredible knowledge of the tale and this, you know, the this sort of particular, you know, very kind of, you know, underloved literary genre, you know, the weird tale, you know, which used to be such a staple of British and American popular fiction, and just because publishing trends has kind of gone by the board now, you know, you've got to write a, you know, science fiction, you have to write a 400-page novel with a gold embossed cover rather than have your idea in 15 pages for amazing stories.
What we're really talking about, I think, here is this notion of how the next generation or the present generation of writers is truly free in their work. I mean, Moorcock was very free with Jerry Cornelius.
Yeah.
You, I suspect, are also very free in Gods Without Men. But then we get into a situation, back to the whole literary genre thing, where, you know, certain literary writers, Glenn Duncan and so forth, they want to moonlight in the genre, and they want to sort of see if they can make a killing or get a wider audience, and it doesn't become necessarily about the art. It becomes about attracting. It
comes about
readership.
Making a living.
I mean, you know. What do you do to combat this? I mean, do you care about a readership? Are you truly free in your writing? Is it about
I've taken the position that I want to write in a way, you know, I've not published very much that's highly formally experimental, and I'm happy that part of my project as a writer of novels, less as short stories. You can fool around in short stories more, but as a writer of novels, I'm actually trying to reach a readership. You know, I'm never going to be a very popular novelist, I don't think, because I'm just not interested enough in that thing. But I like the idea that my books will get read, and maybe will get read by people who will be a bit tripped up by some of the stuff they find in them.
Yeah.
I like that idea of reaching out into the world a bit. And, you know, and I'd also, you know, this is sort of speaking to this notion about why is the novel so impure and why is it not kind of, you know, more like a kind of modernist art form. And I think that, you know, the novel from its inception has been a real baggy monster. It was, you know, it was you know, entertainment for 18th century ladies. You know, it was never a high art until much, you know, until kind of, you know, 100 years or more into its existence as a form. And the idea that it can be sublimated into this sort of pure modernist high art project, you know, I mean there are pure modernist novels, but it's simply, you have to force the novel to go in that direction. If that's what you want to do with the novel, you've got a lot of levering to do, and you've got to kind of hit the baggy bits on the head, and you often have to kind of strip your, you know, words are very impure. Novels get mixed up in the world. They get mixed up in the world of the writer that makes them, of the reader, of, you know, they're somehow always, you know, they've got this tendency to kind of leak away from a kind of high art into a popular form. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with the hybrid nature of that.
Yeah. I want to also ask you about physical location. I mean, the acknowledgments page reveals that you had
traveled a lot.
And,
yeah.
I know you do travel writing. You wrote most of this in hotels and motel rooms in various locations. I mean, you know, first of all, there's two questions. One, did you actually experience a purple lilac-based hotel room?
Oh, yes.
You
did. And a lot of really bad. There's a sort of deodorant that they, it's like a kind of air freshener that they use in a lot of cheap motels. Which it kind of, as soon as it kind of hits you, it's like, oh no, another one of these. And it somehow seems to go along with a kind of taste for highly artificial, flammable lilac fiber. there's some feats of decorating that are pretty scary.
Well, the other question, more profound, I suppose, is, you know, this idea of being close to a location as you're writing about it.
Mm.
I mean, how does location work for you? Do you need to be removed? Yeah. Do you need to check it out every so often?
I really prefer to go to somewhere if I'm going to write about it.
Yeah.
A lot of the book was written, you know, away from the desert, but I did a lot of traveling in the desert, and it was, you know, a lot of the writing in the hotel and the motel rooms was kind of first drafts and sort of impressionistic stuff, because there is stuff that you find out by being in a place, and it's usually very sensory material. Like, you know, I'm probably one of the few people in history who can put his hand on his heart and say that I went to Burning Man and it was a business expense. And you know, almost the best thing I got out of that experience, which is basically you're living on a salt flat for a week, you know, having a nice time, but
you're lucky now you can get in.
Right, yeah, this it's all become like kind of, that's terrible, isn't it?
So much for this great utopia.
Yeah, right. It's a very 400 buck a ticket simulated free economy. But the most important thing that I got out of that was the experience of the dust storms. As soon as the wind gets up the dust rises up, and you go from kind of crystal clear blue sky, amazing visibility, to zero visibility, and you're coated in this flower-like dust. And that's an incredible experience. And that kind of thing you couldn't get by reading about it. The kind of actually physically traveling across the landscape, you know, whether you're ideally walking. I was very wary of doing, a lot of these trips have been on my own, and the idea of, you know, parking the car and walking across desert country, you got to know what you're doing in order to do that, and you should tell people where you're going and, you know, all that kind of thing. So I didn't do as much off, you know, backcountry walking as I would have liked, and I'd still like to do if I can find.
Sounds as disastrous as Nikki's experience.
Yeah, right. You don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that guy. Kind of, you know, high as a kite, walking around in a circle, and you know, with the rattlesnakes. But just things to do with light, things to do with thin air, things to do with color or absence of color, like, you know, midday in the Mojave in summer when the sun is vertical hitting the white earth, it just bleaches out everything. You're kind of in this incredibly weird low contrast world, you know, that kind of stuff. You don't, you know, you have to be in a space. And actually, the germ of the book was out of travel rather than the travel was initially for the book. You know, there was something about being in that place when I first went there that felt to me that it was mystical and transcendental and kind of, and hence was very challenging to my materialist perception of the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of words, what you were talking about earlier, the one thing about the geodesic dome in this is that you actually never use the word geodesic.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there was a certain limitations along these lines that you placed into writing about Utopia, that you had to have the language itself be as blind as dawn.
Sometimes, and I love technical vocabulary of any register. I can get a real kick out of just reading lists of specialist words, especially Latinate sciencey words, you know, geodesic being, you know, there's Greek kind of, sometimes, you know, if you have the option of doing it without the $5 word, because you don't want to kind of the reader to dwell on that, then sometimes you make the choice not to use it. I mean, this book is filled with technical vocabulary and specialist vocabulary of various kind, ranging from kind of Mormon religious terms and alchemical terms, you know, through to, you know, stuff to do with finance. So there's plenty of that stuff around, and you know, occasionally you want to just sort of flatten it out to kind of make sure that they keep through the sentence rather than getting tripped up in the sentence.
Yes.
You know?
The other thing I was curious about is going back to Walter. Well, you have, of course, the computer virus and transmission after the Bollywood star. So it seems to me that the truest deities in your books tend to involve computers, and I'm wondering why this is.
Because I've grown up with computers, and it's a mystery to me why more people aren't writing outside science fiction. More people aren't kind of engaging with what computers actually, you know, how they're integrated into our daily lives. I mean, they're quite domesticated objects now, but also, if we actually look at what we really are doing with our days, especially as, you know, information workers, you know, this is a world that's increasingly imbricated in our physical world. And I'm interested in, for example, the ways that people kind of escape into a digital world that is potentially knowable and absolute and has rules. That seems to be a very masculine solution to the complexities of the world, the emotional world.
By the way, what was your first computer?
My first computer was something called a ZX Spectrum, which was a British made
like the Timex Sinclair 1000, the ZDX81.
The
Timex Sinclair 1000 was my first computer.
Right,
too.
This was the one that did color that came after the ZX80 and the 81. Okay. And I still have it, actually. And it had these terrible rubber keys. And, you know, you programmed it in BASIC. And,
the 2000 here, it was the color computer. And then there was the 1000 had the black with the little expansion pack on the back, 16K
exactly,
thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then this is the next iteration of that.
It had a little kind of rainbow thing on the corner.
Right.
And about sort of yay big. And, and so I fooled around with that, and at school they got these things called BBC Micros, which is an amazing kind of social democratic kind of European notion that the BBC could kind of be a computer manufacturer. They partnered with, I forget which kind of, maybe it was Commodore or someone like that, and made these schools computers. So my first memory of using a computer was actually a network. which was a friend of my father's had a login to a university computer, and I must have been like 8 or 9, so we're talking 78, 79, and he had one of those cradle modems where an old-fashioned kind of phone handset could kind of be physically placed into the modem, and he had a terminal in his home, and it was linked into a university computer somewhere, and he showed me how to play Lunar Lander. I believe the lander at that point was made up, was like a kind of a dash and a one and a zero, so you could see this thing moving up and down the screen, and you were controlling it by typing in figures for sort of velocity and so on and so forth. And I also played an adventure on that.
Of course.
And those were kind of big experiences for an 8-year-old. And I fell off the end of computers. I wasn't, I stopped having much to do with computers for my later teens because I wasn't very interested in them. And then kind of got back into them around about kind of end of my college years. You know, actually, I suppose one of the most important moments really was I went back, I did an undergraduate English literature degree, went on the dole for a year and a half trying to write this terrible Pynchonesque novel, and I was kind of slightly sort of falling off the end of things. I was in a very sort of sketchy world. I realized I needed to try and earn some money, or thought maybe I could become an academic. Went back and did a philosophy master's degree, and was immediately very aware that I didn't want to be a philosopher, professional philosopher. Loved the material, hated the institution. But was also much more interested in the stuff that was going on down the hall. I was there to supposedly study philosophy and literature, lots of German Romanticism and continental philosophy. And there was guys down the hall were doing all this AI stuff, and they were dicking around with the internet. And this is sort of 92.
Yeah.
And so I got an internet. I got my first email address.
Yeah.
Then got an internet connection, and then suddenly realized that there was this strange... So it was just migrating from BBSs to the World Wide Web at that point. Yes. And just, you know, the first time I came up with somebody's kind of conspiracy theory site, I was just like...
Did you subscribe to Conspiracy Nation, that email newsletter back in the day?
I think I might have done,
I was on that for a while, and they'd have, like, you know, long interviews with Chomsky and stuff.
And this
like, kind of... Like, they would go on for, like, about 25 different emails.
Right, and suddenly you've got access to all these people and this kind of culture that previously you would have been sending, you know, I was sending stamped addressed envelopes off for it. It was just a joy.
Yeah.
You know, and realizing that there was this kind of, you know, I could connect to the world of weirdness from my desktop, you know.
Yeah.
It was a revelation. And then very one thing led to another, and really sort of weirdly soon I managed to get a piece into the new British edition of Wired magazine, and at the time I was really playing catch up on all the technical stuff. I was bullshitting that I knew a lot more than I did, you know, and they'd send me off to kind of interview engineers about what they were doing, and I would have to kind of stay up late and researching so that I would not make a fool of myself, so I would actually understand what an IP stack was, you know, actually know what a generative algorithm was. And that whole technical register, you know, and realizing that was making culture. I mean, that was very clear to me from the beginning that, you know, the engineers were part of culture, that they were should be treated as creative, important people who were, you know, and this kind of collision of strange subcultural world, high tech, and what has happened, you know, the absolute transformation of our social world through the internet, you know, that was an amazing thing, and that was very formation, you know, it was foundational for me as a person.
Information was your formation.
Yeah.
So information was really the muse, journalism, but was this really the way for you to get into fiction? I mean, did you need to be connected to all of these little nuggets? Did you need to find out about stuff in order to really actuate that fiction writing brain?
I mean, I think I already had the impulse to write fiction because I was a reader from such a young age, and what I appreciated so much in fiction was the ability to transport me out of my situation into you know, into other worlds.
Yeah.
But to find a form that seems, you know, I think I'm still groping towards that. I mean, I'm pleased with this last novel because I think I'm beginning to find a way of working that feels like it can speak about now and feels like it can kind of deal with all the different interests that I have and want to bring into the novel. You know, I certainly think of the network as a primary form in all sorts of senses of that word for art now and for understanding culture now. And I mean, my novels aspire to a kind of networked state. Yeah.
Yes. Well, speaking of which, I actually wanted to ask you about, well, we got into a little bit of a pissing match on Twitter
over
this.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
I mean, I don't care. I'm not pissed now because I got the book and we're having this conversation. So, but I was curious about the results of the social media experiment where you were going to place specific social media figures and prioritize them over bookish journalists, other fiction writers, yeah, and so
that's,
forth.
That's what you thought I was doing, and you were wrong. That wasn't what I was doing.
Well, yes.
So the idea was, it was supposed to be kind of put your money where your mouth is, yeah, about how word of mouth actually happens. Because, yeah, I think there are great book journalists, there are bad book journalists, there are people who have a profound influence on the taste of their peers who maybe aren't necessarily connected formally to the book world. And I thought, well, we've got some extra copies to give out. Still, all the usual suspects are going to get their review copy, yeah, and they're going to be taken seriously, and they're going to be, you know, their views will be heard. But why would I not want, for example, a really interesting computer engineer,
yeah,
to have a copy and to circulate it in his or her milieu? Oh,
and I was with you there. Well, the thing I was worried about was that you were purging certain people from your original
list.
That really.
So, and this is the first time it had been tried by this. Yeah. So basically, old buddy of mine from the Wired days, who's business head, Sky Azim, set up this peer index influence company. And he approached me and said, do you want to do a giveaway?
Yeah.
We can help you, you know, make the proposition, make the list. And as it turned out, you know, the initial version of it was awful because people kind of came onto the site and they go, do you qualify for a free copy?
Yeah.
And basically, unless your name was on this pre-existing list that they'd made up,
yeah,
you got like, no, you don't qualify. And so all these people were just going, well, screw you then. And that was exactly the experience. That was how I would have reacted to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so by back to kind of day two, we took that down and basically said it was something like kind of put your name down for a free copy. And as it turned out, I thought they had I think this is clearly in its infancy, this whole thing. Their metrics were kind of pretty basic, you know, they're just looking at number of Twitter followers and a certain kind of amount about linking and so on. I mean, I think I probably could have put together just a sort of list, actually, you know, of interesting folk and sent them a book, and that might have worked just as well. But I still think, in principle, that idea of kind of seeding a book into some different places is a good one. And I don't think literary journalists are the only people who contribute to the way books find their audience in the world. I'd say it was interesting rather than a grand success.
How does one expand from the initial bookish literary base? I mean, is it really about using social media? Is it about engaging in ideas that, say, are outside the literary mode?
Yeah, I think that's probably it, actually. Yeah. You know, I think it's I've had a... Just before I came out, I saw somebody written up a speech that Jonathan Franzen gave saying he finds Twitter immensely irritating.
JB Adverk's report,
And, you know, clearly he's never used it. He's kind of, you know, he's got the idea that everyone's just talking about their cat and it would be noise. And actually, I found it incredibly productive, both as a sort of source of news and as a way of finding who your people are.
Yeah.
And I'd say that's one way for a writer to discover who your people are, is who you end up actually, just in a straight, rather than make it, I mean, people, I think, There's all this stuff that would go on at the AWP or whatever about Twitter as a marketing tool. But you know who wants to be marketed to by yet another medium? What you want on something like social media is a bunch of interesting folk to hang out with, to shoot the shit over the Oscars with. I mean, that's what you do. That's what it's good for. And also, being present in other areas. You know, I'm the kind of fiction writer who also gets involved in stuff that's absolutely nothing to do with the business of writing fiction. And I think that has helped, again, to kind of find who my people are and, you know, and to kind of people triangulate each other, their range of interests. You know, if you know that I will tend to sound off about Syria or something, then, you know, you maybe have a kind of greater idea of what you might get if you were to sort of drop some money on one of my books.
Yeah. To sort of find an end to this conversation, which has been quite fun, I was wondering if we could talk about this notion of faith again, just to provide a sort of circular kind of mode for this. I mean, what do you do to someone who may be reading your novel and say, well, you know, Harry Kunzru is like a completely godless, faithless person? I mean, you value freedom of expression very highly. How is that compatible with what one person sees as freedom of religion, which is going to be on the same standard? Do you have any solutions to, from a secular person to get through to a religious extremist?
Firstly, I would say that the fact that you aren't a member of an organized religion and don't profess the traditional religious faith does not in any way mean that you aren't engaged in ethical and moral questions, or that, you know, you value human agency or whatever it is. I think that's a misconception that religious people tend to have about non-religious people, that we're not engaged in these questions and that we're engaged seriously. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that doubt is a strongly ethical position in many circumstances. Secondly, you know, I'd say that freedom of religion is freedom to exercise your faith without being imposed on by other people, and the limits of that are are whether you're exercising your faith is going to damage or, you know, cause violence to other people, and actually the best protection for freedom of religion is freedom of speech. And I would say that if you feel offended, there's a solution that's not to do with law, that's to do with the public space and to do with the world of civil society, which, to counter speech is more speech. You explain why, you engage with the people that you're disagreeing with, and you know, through that process you'll find greater understanding. And that is, you know, that is the way I approach opponents in these kind of debates.
But when you read the Satanic Verses in Jaipur, you were accused of Islam bashing under the guise of liberalism. So the question is, you know, does offending people, should this be held above, you know, not offending people? Or,
well, I mean, actually, the people accused me of that weren't there. They didn't know what I read. They don't know what I said. You know, what I actually read was a short passage about religious doubt. And my intention was actually to open up debate. I mean, there is a real situation about kind of class and Islam in India, in that Muslims often tend to be to be poorer, to have less access to services and so on and so forth. And so there's a kind of there's a class question that does get kind of folded into that. But is the idea that, you know, it comes again and again, the idea that freedom of speech is just basically a way of doing down Islam. I think Muslims fail to understand that people like me, who are defending freedom of speech for all and defending unpopular points of view, that's actually, you know, we're better friends to the believing Muslim than some of the religious folk who actually just want license to bash them without any guises at all.
Well, that seems an interesting note to end this very long conversation.
I don't know, it's probably in the afternoon now.
But thanks so much, it was a pleasure to chat.
Likewise.